rights, liberty or life, if they can bring about the results desired. Public declarations concerning Mormon polygamy abounded in 19th century America. What they nearly always shared, regardless of their source or position, was a zealous polarized quality, an unyielding insistence on their exclusive moral rightness. Yet such a rigid representation of polygamy might perplex anyone familiar with the convoluted history of plural marriage in America. Since its inception with the Mormons in the 19th century, the American practice of polygamy has been, for those who have lived it, as for those who have studied it, a very complex matter. And I'm sure many of you in this room know that as well or better than I from your studies of Mormon history. I didn't want to not add that last clause and imply that you were practicing polygamists, though you may well be, and if that's the case, I'd like to talk to you after. Indeed, to 19th century Mormons themselves, polygamy, while a galvanizing, even glorious way of life, was also confusing, traumatic, and divisive. Nevertheless, the unique social phenomenon of polygamy fueled a fierce ideological battle between the Mormons on the one hand and the U.S. government and the American public on the other, in which both sides represented polygamy, despite its complexity, in morally simplistic terms and images. In this paper, I want briefly to consider the nature of what I will call the reductive rhetoric that typified competing 19th century moral narratives about polygamy. Narratives that found expression in congressional debate, political commentary, religious sermons and publications, legal arguments, and other kinds of public discourse. In reading this brief exploration, I want to suggest several questions that have motivated my interest in this subject. First, why did partisans in the public debate over polygamy depict this multifaceted and obviously complex cultural and religious phenomenon in such singular, imperious moral terms? Why did the countless authors of these rigid, dueling narratives, and by this authors of these narratives, I'm using the term narrative very broadly, I mean people like church leaders, politicians, novelists, and so forth, why did the authors of these dueling narratives, all invoking to some degree the institutional voices of God and state, divest the experience of polygamy of any moral ambiguity? Why were self-righteous, unambiguous voices so much louder than the voices of those who actually participated in the complex experience of polygamy, the majority of whom were Mormon women? It's a matter of math. More generally, how might we explain the strong collective impulse, at least among Americans, to talk about social controversies like polygamy so as to maintain a certain kind of clear moral order, even if maintaining that rigid view of things comes at remarkable intellectual and emotional cost? Of course, unyielding language, such as that spoken by Congressman McClernand or Church President Taylor, has often marked public, official, institutional representations of nettlesome social issues in American life. In fact, once we discount a century's worth of linguistic change, we might find it difficult to distinguish between the bellicose statements that I have quoted from thus far and the holy rhetoric that surrounds controversial public issues today: abortion, homosexuality, drugs, pornography, welfare, Heaven's Gate, and so forth. Just try to imagine any level of subtlety or nuance in a soundbite debate between, say, Newt Gingrich and Jesse Jackson, and you might get an impression of what I'm trying to say. This kind of grandiose language often is, to risk an oxymoron, grandly reductive, invoking sweeping authority to preempt doubt or disagreement. Again, for the sake of convenience, I will call this basic tendency rhetorical reductivism throughout the paper. It inhibits meaningful public discussion and blinds us to the ethical and experiential complexity of a social practice like polygamy. We shouldn't be surprised that simple binary rhetoric characterizes our accounts of controversial social issues. Perhaps such simplification is necessary to repress or otherwise manage the public and personal anxiety that attends these issues. This is the key to my argument here. I want to suggest that righteous, simplistic public responses betoken an underlying ambivalence that emerges most clearly when we are forced to consider difficult questions about who we are, individually and collectively. There are many examples I could cite, but this one that seems particularly useful these days is the example of the public debate about sexual orientation. Public and private anxiety seems heavy in much of the self-righteous public discourse about, for example, gays and lesbians serving in the military, about Colorado's recent amendment, prohibited laws meant to protect gays and lesbians from discrimination, about the Hawaiian Supreme Court's legal recognition of same-sex marriages and the idea of gay parents adopting children, about Utah legislation banning gay and lesbian clubs in high schools, and even about the TV character Ellen on the April 30th episode of a TV show as a lesbian. I guess there were visuals. I lied. I picked this example because, much like polygamy in the 19th century, And this resonance has become more and more interesting to me over time as it sort of forces itself into my work. Gay and lesbian culture today seems to threaten an awfully broad range of people of very different positions on other matters who wouldn't normally come together, who constitute a kind of loose mainstream. And I think much of this threat, just as with polygamy, has to do with feelings that people have about two very basic identity issues, family and sexuality. To enrich our thinking about the rhetorical reductivism that characterized public debate about polygamy in the 19th century in America, and to think about how that kind of polarization characterizes our public conversations today, I want to briefly draw on two people who, while coming at this from rather different perspectives, offer some helpful ideas about why we aren't very good at talking about controversial identity issues. First, sociologist Jerome Skolnick, who has examined how people respond to social controversy in various contexts, has argued that mainstream society often chooses to categorize threatening behaviors and practices as vices, things like gambling, drugs, adultery, prostitution, and so forth. Skolnick suggests that public controversy surrounds such issues because we feel moral ambivalence toward them. The reason for this, according to Skolnick, is that such vices, rather than being simply and completely evil or immoral, are more complex than that, creating in us feelings of pleasure and popularity as well as wickedness. Hence the idea about moral ambivalence, because vice is a conduct that a person may enjoy and deplore at the same time. Now, this may not apply to every one of these examples for everybody, but I think you'll see that there's a pattern that is at least worth reasoning about here. This theory of vice offers interesting possibilities for the Mormon polygamy controversy, because polygamy was and continues to be at least a source of great ambivalence to Mormons and to their critics. In short, perhaps we should view polygamy as a kind of vice in this broad sense, because it's a social practice that has never failed to create intense, polarized reaction from practitioners and critics alike. If we look at polygamy this way, then we might interpret the rhetorically reductive public conversations that polygamy generates as indicating something other than clear moral conviction. Perhaps they indicate internal dividedness, uncertainty about who we are. I'll leave that for a moment. Second idea I want to bring in before I focus on polygamy a little bit, historically, is from literary scholar Harold Bloom, who so keenly examined Mormonism and other uniquely American Christian religions in his 1992 book, The American Religion, which I imagine many of you have looked at. He suggested that the American religion itself may be, more than any particular creed, a zealous will to know and represent what we believe. Unfortunately, this yearning for sure knowledge tends to manifest itself on the stage of public conversation with such force and certainty that the complex contradictions of human experience are often pushed aside. Indeed, Bloom suggests that what amounts to the American religion may be the worship of the undivided, unexamined self, a kind of believing and professing so desperately focused that little genuine growth is possible. Thus, Bloom could make the following only slightly ironic observation about our all-consuming religious disposition as Americans. No Western nation is as religion-soaked as ours, where 9 out of 10 of us love God and are loved by God in return. That mutual passion centers our society and demands some understanding if our doom-eager society is to be understood at all. I want to echo Bloom's call for understanding, particularly for an understanding of the complex realities of human experience that lie beneath a controversial social practice like polygamy. To move toward this kind of understanding, we must look beyond cleanly drawn lines of moral simplification to the underlying dimensions of a controversial social practice and to its intricate relations to history, circumstance, ideology, and will. In the time that remains, I want to probe around a few of these clean lines drawn by 19th century Americans when they represented Mormon polygamy, whether they were Mormons or anti-Mormons. I don't intend to pronounce upon the rightness or wrongness of any side in this rhetorical battle, though I have my opinions, but to play, as it were, the role of Edward Said's intellectual, at least for an hour, who seeks to break down the stereotypes and reductive categories that so limit human thought and communication. I will focus on two issues. First, the political and social debate about the role and experience of women in Mormon polygamy. And second, public characterizations of the sexual aspects of Mormon polygamy in 19th century America. I'll skip my coverage of sort of the pertinent history of the saints move westward, because I know you all know that well, and begin further into my next section. Joseph Smith preached to his followers that polygamous marriage was the most holy and important doctrine ever revealed to man on the earth, a sacred tradition rooted in the Old Testament, a practice central to the full restoration of Christ's true church, and a solemn ritual that sealed a man and a woman together for all eternity. This theological justification for plural marriage contributed to the firmly held and officially published belief that polygamy, so integral a part of the Mormon exercise of religion, was clearly protected by the divinely inspired U.S. Constitution. In the words of one Mormon publicist, "The Constitution and laws of the United States, being founded upon the principles of freedom, do not interfere with marriage relations, but leave the nation free to believe in and practice the doctrine of a plurality of wives, or to confine themselves to the one-wife system, just as they choose." Despite the persecution that had driven them westward, the Mormons were thus confident that they could safely practice their religion in the Utah desert, where they could build and populate God's kingdom. American society, as we know, did not share this view. While the present-day image of Mormons is that of an honest, peaceful, frugal, hardworking, and prosperous people, the ideal Republican, many 19th-century Americans perceived Mormons as a bizarre cult of religious fanatics who had rejected conventional Christianity to form an insular spiritual community based on an exclusive and ambitious theology. Mormons called themselves saints, and non-believers, Gentiles. Mormons believed in modern-day revelations, visiting angels in golden plates, and the possibility of eventual godhood. And perhaps most sensational of all, Mormons practiced polygamy. Polygamy was repugnant to mainstream American values regarding the configuration and politics of marriage, and public response was fierce. In 1856, for instance, the first Republican Party platform proclaimed both the right and the imperative duty of Congress to prohibit in the territories those twin relics of barbarism, slavery and Mormon polygamy. This statement reflected the common fear that polygamy, like slavery, would spread to the territories. Polygamy had spread to the Utah Territory, of course, but perhaps the most interesting question is why Americans would equate the ostensibly consensual practice of polygamy, plural marriage, with the undeniably coercive practice of slavery. In fact, many Americans, including novelist and social activist Harriet Beecher Stowe, viewed plural marriage as anything but consensual. Polygamy was merely a different kind of, quote, degrading bondage, a cruel slavery whose chains have cut into the very hearts of thousands of our sisters. And Jenny Froiseth, author of The Women of Mormonism, or The Story of Polygamy as Told by the Victims Themselves, declared that the cornerstone of polygamy is the degradation of woman. In the face of this harsh public portrait of Mormon polygamy as women's serfdom, the church dug in its heels, issuing official statements about the role of women that did nothing to refute the public impression that Mormon wives, polygamous or otherwise, lived in servitude to their husbands. On the contrary, the church seemed bent on reinforcing the general Victorian image of women as subject to male authority. For example, in 1852, at the behest of Brigham Young, Church Apostle Orson Pratt prepared Celestial Marriage, a lengthy defense of polygamy that coincided with the church's 1852 public announcement of plural marriage. Pratt, probably the church's chief apologist for polygamy, characterized the woman's place in the family in these distinctly Pauline terms. The husband is the head of the family, and it is his duty to govern his wife or wives and the children according to the laws of righteousness. And it is the duty of the wife to be subject unto him in all things, even as the church is subject unto Christ. Such patriarchal pronouncements undoubtedly contributed to the popular notion that Mormons, regardless of their theological justifications, had constructed their polygamous system to imitate the harems of Oriental concubines in which the women were near slaves. Many Mormon plural wives might have disagreed with these stark characterizations of their way of life, for their first-hand accounts suggest that the experience of polygamy was complex and heterogeneous. Indeed, Carlo Mayer has concluded his detailed survey of such women's personal narratives with this observation. Plural marriage was a complex phenomenon in both theology and practice. It was no less complex psychologically. Some LDS women ardently accepted it as a divine principle. Others viewed it as an unwelcome but necessary sacrifice to achieve salvation. A few loathed it. There were women who coaxed reluctant husbands to take an additional wife. Others quietly acquiesced, either in initial discussions or when presented with a fait accompli, and still others left the household rather than accept a sister wife. Sometimes the inner and outer persons were in conflict. Inwardly repelled and outwardly obedient, many women faced a struggle that for some led to triumphant self-control and for others to shattering disillusionment. The practice of plural marriage, like any experience involving intimate social relationships, did not lend itself transparently to uniform interpretation. Yet most Americans derived their impression of Mormon polygamy almost exclusively from the nightmarish personal accounts published in popular books like Jenny Bartlett's Elder Northfield's Home or Sacrificed on the Mormon Altar, A Story of the Blighting Curse of Polygamy. The New York Times also contributed significantly to this national impression, which is far less objective than it is now, making sure consistently to demonize the Mormon polygamists. In 1882, for example, after The World had published a benign report on the Mormons, the Times reprinted the article, followed by a demand, What can the editor's object be in making his paper the apologist for a false and degrading religion? According to the New York Times, the editor of The World must have been angling to provide himself with as many wives as he now holds shares of stock. And a year later, after many Protestant churches had organized mass meetings in large American cities to draft resolutions urging Congress to take further action against the Mormons, the Times editorial page relished the chance to point a pious finger at the Mormons, pronouncing them a class of sinners providentially supplied for the purpose of enabling eloquent ministers to preach powerful sermons without offending any possible pew holder. Such sweeping condemnations of polygamy, like the Church's own dogmatic apologies, could only have obscured the complex nature of the polygamous experience for the Mormon women asked to embrace it. Thoughtful voices were few, but notable. For example, John Stuart Mill, perhaps annoyed by the sheer volume of ridicule applied to Mormon polygamists, or possibly alert to the hypocrisy of a larger culture blind to its own conventional forms of misogyny and marital inequity, called for a more careful approach to the Mormon question. Marveling at the language of downright persecution which breaks out from the press of this country whenever it feels called upon to notice the remarkable phenomenon of Mormonism, Mill argued for a kind of pro-choice position on the issue of plural marriage. It must be remembered that this relation is as much voluntary on the part of women concerned in it as is the case with any other form of marriage institution. I cannot admit that persons entirely unconnected with them ought to step in and require that a condition of things with which all who are directly interested appear to be satisfied should be put an end to, because it is a scandal to persons some thousands of miles distant who have no part or concern in it. The great way of propositions. From a late 20th century vantage point, Mill's position may seem somewhat archaic, even naive. That is, whether Mormon women were genuinely free to choose or refuse to enter plural marriage may now seem highly debatable, when the idea of the autonomous will of the liberal subject and the machinery of individual consent are increasingly seen as problematic, at least in academic circles. However, however we characterize the 19th century Mormon woman's choice to accept plural marriage, we must consider the difficult implications of that choice in historical context. Martha Bradley and Mary Woodward have pointed out that for 19th century Mormon women, choosing to believe in the divine calling Joseph Smith was itself a kind of threshold paradigm choice of epistemological significance, which narrowed all ensuing practical decisions. In this sense, polygamy was another version of the classic conflict between faith and reason. I'm quoting. Feminist interpretation of plural marriage sees that although women were willing to restructure their lives along new and often radical lines, they believed Joseph Smith was expressing the will of God by recreating patriarchal precedents from the Bible. Mormon patriarchy reflected his attempt to redefine, reorder, and maintain social control through male priesthood. He did this by invoking the moral authority of revelation, priesthood power, and the principle of obedience. We must not underestimate the impact of Smith's prologue of visions and angels and his private instructions to young women. If they believed, then the logical consequence was their total submission to his judgment, his authority, and his power. If they did not believe, there was no way for them to remain members of his church. Bradley and Woodward further observe that for 19th century American women generally, marriage itself was a categorical decision of inestimable impact, the first moment in their adult lives when they were empowered. Choosing to marry or not to marry, and whom to marry, radically changed the boundaries of their lives. Given the dramatic nature of the marriage decision, it becomes comprehensible that a woman might have entered plural marriage out of what anthropologist Rex Cooper has called a real fear for survival. Indeed, if a woman came to invest her belief in the grandeur of LDS theology, accepting polygamy might be regarded as an attempt to maintain Mormon group identity and provide for Mormon salvation despite any eventuality. It may seem ironic that some Mormon women also linked these concerns about survival and identity to what they viewed as a larger, more progressive sensibility about their religion. When they chose to enter a patriarchal religious community, they did so because they valued and believed in they believed that the gender system was organized around family-centered and woman-oriented values. The network of familial relationships created through plural marriage created a new and unique sense of community, of family, and of self. And I'm quoting from Woodward and Bradley there. From this perspective, many Mormon women saw polygamy as a new social institution that they were able to accept by redefining it in terms of a female worldview. These progressive images of self and community seem almost more characteristic of the culture of 19th century American utopian yearning than they do of predominant 19th century patriarchal ideologies. Perhaps even more striking, despite the obvious contextual differences, such images seem resonant of what well-known legal feminist Catherine McKinnon has suggested is the Sisyphean task of feminist methodology, to make possible the expression of women's situation in which the struggle for consciousness is a struggle for world, for a sexuality, a history, a culture, a community, a form of power, an experience of the sacred. Just as some Mormon women recast polygamy with the potential for a kind of expanded identity and self-empowerment, so some also engaged in a surprising political activism that made official church pronouncements seem incongruous with these women's real experiences. For example, Mormon women organized the successful campaign for suffrage in Utah, which left anti-Mormon critics perplexed as to why the last outpost of barbarism should have extended the vote to women in 1870, 50 years before the nation adopted the 19th Amendment, and decades before women's suffrage had acquired respectability elsewhere. Mormon women also published the Woman's Exponent, a journal that was decidedly outspoken on political and social matters of the day, in which many of us read to this day in a somewhat different form. One editorial, for instance, said this of the relative importance of men in women's lives: "Is there then nothing worth living for but to be petted, humored, and caressed by a man? That is all very well as far as it goes, but that man is the only thing in existence worth living for, I fail to see. And when men see that women can exist without their being constantly at hand, that they can learn to be self-reliant or depend upon each other more or less for happiness, it will perhaps take a little of the conceit out of some of them." This idea of depending upon each other more or less for happiness makes special sense when one considers the significant personal implications of plural marriage for a Mormon woman. The practical requirements of living as plural wives challenged the limiting stereotype of women accepted by civilized America. A plural wife could not be the helpless, fainting, protected female, or she would likely faint alone. Plural wives often had to look to themselves rather than their husbands for financial support and physical labor. For practical purposes, many were more like widows than traditional wives. The regular absence of their husbands simplified their housekeeping chores, allowing them to participate in a broader range of activities than their Eastern sisters. In one of the neatest ironic contradictions of the period, the enslaved harems of Utah produced some of America's most efficient early feminists. Ultimately, it is difficult not to see something of a cultural anomaly in the varied experience of Mormon polygamous women, notwithstanding simplistic public representations from both the church and its critics. Mormon polygamy certainly was not unique as an occasion on which the complexity of women's experience has been appropriated by the dominant moral rhetorics of a patriarchal culture. Nevertheless, polygamy forced an excruciating decision on the women who were asked to practice it, a decision whose import and demands were seldom, if ever, acknowledged in the rhetorical battles waged on the stage of public morality. As Claudia Bushman has described it, "For the women of Zion, the importance of polygamy cannot be overstressed, even though only a small portion of the populace was directly involved. The Mormon sisters were required to defend the principle or leave the church entirely. They had to make plural marriage work to prove they were right. The principle, more than anything else, set up a competition between the Mormons and the Gentiles, the first intent on proving their righteousness, and the second on forcing the miscreant group to recant their evil ways. Hence the charged decision of whether to accept plural marriage, its heavy personal consequences, and the inevitable rhetorical reductivism that controlled its representation in public debate. All these created an airless atmosphere of stringent moral competition in which nuanced and meaningful public debate about plural marriage, let alone about underlying issues of family, configuration, gender politics, and sexual identity, was virtually impossible." Briefly now, I'd like to focus on 19th century representations of Mormon polygamy as a sexual behavior. These representations of the sexual dimensions of plural marriage illuminate especially well the rhetorical reductivism that I've attempted to highlight here, in large part because American ambivalence about sex runs deep. Indeed, on the subject of sex, my working thesis, that righteous public rhetoric about vice signals moral ambivalence underneath it. This thesis finds ample support in the dueling public moral narratives about polygamy in the 19th century. The public's obsession with the sexual implications of Mormon polygamy manifested itself through an incongruous coalition of non-Mormon businessmen and politicians, their wives, clergymen, federal officials stationed in Utah, and reporters who bombarded the nation with tales of Mormondom, usually shocking, sometimes amusing. Sensational books such as Fanny Stenhouse's Tell It All, The Story of a Woman's Life in Polygamy, and Anne Eliza Young's Wife Number 19, A Life in Bondage, a full expose of Mormonism. Incidentally, Anne Eliza Young was married to Brigham Young from 1873 to 1883, and she delivered nearly 2,000 lectures, sometimes earning as much as $20,000 a year for exposing this. These things, as well as stern public lectures and homilies about the evils of polygamy, served the purpose of a national titillation. A concern with polygamy was a respectable way in which Americans could indulge in sexual daydreams by learning intimate details, or so they fancied, of life in the mysteriously exciting Mormon harems. The extent to which sexual daydreams motivated such widespread public condemnation is unclear, but sex was undeniably a prime focus. Thus, in 1870, Representative Cullum of Illinois, they always seem to be from Illinois, would argue before Congress that polygamy, instead of being a holy principle receiving the sanction of heaven, is an institution founded in the lustful and unbridled passions of men, devised by Satan himself to destroy purity and authorize whoredom. And a decade later, Harper's New Monthly Magazine would declare that the Mormon religion offers a perpetual premium for men's lusts. Their teachings kill the germ of chastity in the hearts of childhood before it is ever warmed into life. While the New York Times would editorialize that the strongest element of the Mormon faith was the shrewd and cunning appeal to the brutal and sensual instincts, that in Mormonism men saw an opportunity for unrestricted license of the grosser passions, and women are deluded into a fanatical idea of being spiritual wives of saints. But if in their public representation the Gentiles tended to reduce Mormon polygamy to a manipulative patriarchal system of sheer carnal indulgence, the Mormons, for their part, responded officially with much pious self-assurance. Church Apostle Orson Pratt, again, who, like many Mormon leaders, had come to hold a larger-than-life image of polygamy, argued that instead of a plurality of wives being a cause of sorrow to females, it is one of the greatest blessings of the last dispensation. It gives them the great privilege of being united to a righteous man and of rearing a family according to the order of heaven. The women's alternative to plural marriage, Pratt continued, usually was to marry a wicked man who will ruin her and her offspring. In the polygamous family, on the other hand, peace and salvation reign. Incidentally, as I go through, I'm quoting a lot of things without attributing to authors for the sake of time. I hope you can tell by my slight tilt of the head or blushing that it's either theirs or mine. Such confident proclamations relied on the Mormon doctrine that polygamy was holy, not wicked. As Fawn Brody has remarked, Joseph Smith was no careless libertine who could be content with clandestine mistresses. There was too much of the Puritan in him, and he could not rest until he had redefined the nature of sin and erected a stupendous theological edifice to support his new theories on marriage. Thus, to justify the practice of polygamy necessitated the construction of a truly Manichaean paradigm of human sexuality. As one critic has put it, either our bodies, like the body of Joseph Smith, were to be tabernacles toward the building of the celestial kingdom, or they were to be sepulchres for adultery. This puritanical dichotomy dramatizes the fact that sexuality, ever controversial among humans, found in Mormon polygamy an extraordinary means of threatening the conventional moral order of things. The ideological violence of this conflict, as it played out rhetorically, left no room for compromise. I suggest that this rhetorical impasse over the sexual meanings of polygamy reflects the larger discursive paralysis that prevented constructive public discussion of plural marriage in 19th century America. The warring narratives of polygamy never broke free of their initial violent embrace. On the contrary, this mutual hegemony of two opposed myths, to quote cultural historian R.A. Stradling, served only to reinforce the continuing tyranny of predetermined alternatives of either-or explanations for subjects of public dialogue. Sadly, the impulse to manage moral controversy by reducing public discourse to simple binary terms fed an ongoing cultural legacy of ideological intransigence about important issues that continues today. To conclude, I'd like to consider something written by Orson Scott Card, famous science fiction writer and also a Mormon. A profile of polygamy in the Mormon memory, 100 years after the official end of the practice. Once men and women entered plural marriages, they were utterly committed to Mormonism. There could be no turning back without deserting helpless, beloved children, without renouncing wives or husband. A polygamous Mormon was forced to turn inward to the church, for the outside world viewed him or her with pity at best, revulsion at worst. The long series of battles with the federal government taught generations of saints to have a higher loyalty to their church than to their government, a loyalty that continues even today. Mormons still treasure the myth of persecution. Abuse a Mormon because of his beliefs, and he's almost grateful for the chance to bravely resist you, for it proves that he is worthy of the sacrifices of his ancestors. And I acknowledge that this does not just apply to Mormons. I think if we look at the Middle East, this has even greater resonance. Polygamy named us as a people, and though polygamy is gratefully behind us now, we still live on the strength of its legacy. Such a zealous rhetorical legacy, shared by saints and Gentiles alike, does not bode well for the political climate in which we are trying to make community today. Polygamy, as I suggested at the outset, like communism at one time, or perhaps still now, sexuality or drugs or pornography or any number of other things, raises complex ethical questions about who we are, which is precisely why these issues generate moral ambivalence and stir public controversy. It is also why we typically yield to the intoxicating power of a didactically ordered narrative in our public representation and response. But we stand to lose much in that kind of telling. For if the goal of mutual understanding consistently exceeds the grasp of our public conversation, and this because we habitually framed the difficult moral issue as the easily decidable one. Then we have learned to live in collective denial about ourselves and each other. Perhaps, as Harold Bloom has lamented, this incomprehension is destined to be our lot as Americans. Quote, the American religion, which is nothing if not a knowing, does not know itself. Perhaps this is a permanent and general American irony. We may be uniquely the nation where the knowers cannot know themselves, unquote. If in our public dialogue about controversial issues we fear to explore the cloudy, uncharted realm between conviction and doubt, where we must earn our belief and our identity on the open road of self-understanding, then perhaps we have learned only too well how not to know ourselves. Sadly, we may have learned the most settled form of American worship. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Greg.
Are we taking questions?
Or we're taking questions. Oh, you better stay standing up, I think. Are there any first?
So that was what person in the population was enjoying at the time of
freedom. Can somebody clarify that? I think it was somewhere between 10 and 20% at its most.
It was relatively small amount.
Yes, yes.
It's the Mormon population.
Yes, the Mormon population. Yeah. In the very back?
Someone gave a paper out there years ago that said that percentage-wise, if you can imagine, there were less,
percentage-wise, than there are now. Who's got people who's probably? Is that, maybe we can include fundamentalists? I mean, all people who consider themselves Mormons or
right.
Part of the legacy of Joseph Smith.
Number of fundamentalists compared to this whole population. That's not a new statistic.
You're in the back.
There was an article in Dialogue a few years ago about polygamy and how prevalent it was. And although the percentage of people in polygamy was very low, in 10-20% range, probably, the leadership of the church at all levels were virtually all polygamists.
Right.
It was very rare for people to be in leadership.
Yeah, it very much generated a kind of class system or a reinforced one. Yeah, that's right. Jess?
What do you think of Harold Bloom? You quoted some of that. Harold Bloom's arguments about Joseph Smith and plural marriage and the whole individuation process.
Well, I think you probably know, I've played up more of one sort of side of his analysis than several others. He has a very complex analysis, I think, and he's a pretty controversial figure in my field of literary studies, but I think he says some really interesting things about Joseph Smith. He obviously admires him in many ways and thought of him as a brilliant, charismatic, very unusual person. I guess someone who was able to embody many contradictions. And I think one of the reasons that Bloom at least implies that he's troubled with this sort of American will to sort of make everything cohere is that someone like Joseph Smith was someone who really gave rise to a theology that's very complex and has all kinds of really wonderful contradictions, if looked at from a mythological standpoint and other standpoints. He's a literary critic. And so while I'm trying to use Bloom to say that, to bemoan the state of sort of American religion because we are afraid to sort of look hard at ourselves, I think Bloom would say that Joseph Smith presented an opportunity for a lot of really interesting and complex things that may not have been pursued because of what happens when religions start to evolve in American culture and become much more uniform and public image-oriented. And I'm sure Armin Moss could tell us about the road of assimilation from then to now much better than I. So, yes.
Polygamy being essential to electoral progression and eventual deification of pre-manifesto Mormonism, why do you think it was that there's such a low percentage of Mormons in that time that were playing?
Somebody want to go ahead?
Approximately equal numbers.
not
very much polyandry.
It was a reward. You have to keep that in mind that it went hand in hand with rising in church authority.
Yeah. I mean, I can think of lots of reasons, and some the ones that have been suggested, I'm sure, are very easily substantiated by the scholarship. Just common sense tells me that a lot of people would have tremendous misgivings about it, even if they were committed to the church, as I think I've tried to suggest, and that in itself would certainly create a kind of stop-start progress.
In my mind, it was part of the plan of eternal progression at the time, and it was essential for your eventual national salvation. Why is one more people willing to?
I'm not sure how widely that was preached or understood by everybody. I couldn't say. My guess is that that's an interesting question.
That there are economic reasons.
Go ahead.
There are economic reasons.
Right, like people, men went off to missions a lot, and there were families left with.
Well, in some period, you had to have a farm for each one. We didn't exactly pan out for that.
Yes.
Well, that brings up two questions to me. Of those that did practice it, were more of them required by calling to do it than those who wanted to do it and got to do it because of, I mean, were counselors in bishoprics allowed to do it, for example, as opposed to the bishop or the stake president?
I would think so, but again, I think you can be pretty sure that as you move up the hierarchy, the percentage grows exponentially. And again, if anybody can provide clearer background, there's just so much out there. I don't personally have a very coherent
The other question that came up was if the percentage today is as great who are practicing polygamy. I don't see how it could be with 9 million members of the church, 20% of that is 1.5 million people practicing polygamy. It doesn't fit.
I don't know, but the woman back said that, and I don't have
confirmation. That's more than the population of Utah and Idaho put together.
Yeah.
I had a great-great-grandfather who practiced back in Nauvoo and who was a personal bodyguard of Joseph Smith. When he came to Utah and he took another wife, he was disciplined by Brigham Young for not getting authority to do the practice with his new wife. So it was something I think that was meted out.
And certainly, just to add another dimension to the answer about why some would or wouldn't, my own limited research into George Q. Cannon is that there are a lot of behind-the-scenes politics about this. I mean, I think someone like George Q. Cannon was completely committed to a kind of biblical imperative coupled with Joseph Smith's firm edict that this is the way to the celestial kingdom, and only gave a waiver to that. So everything that he did to sort of make it that was just public dissimulation that he didn't really believe. Whereas someone like Wilford Woodruff was, I think, something more of a great compromiser, was interested in getting statehood and so forth, and was the one who issued the manifesto. I think you have to look at different personalities and different levels of conviction about this. And when you put the personalities together in the hierarchy, and I don't know if Michael Quinn is here, but he could speak volumes about that. Yes.
Yeah, in today's society, we meet someone, we court them, and then we eventually marry them. How is that part of the polygamy taken care of back then? I mean, did they date and court like we do today? I mean, it sounds like this was prearranged marriage.
Well, I think it was all over the map. In fact, I can only give you a limited answer because I think there's so much that of what is known that is all over the place, and B, what is not known is hard to find. What I've learned recently that really surprised me was that a number of women were known as real proposers. They would send letters to people they hadn't even courted and propose to them in some situations. I'm not saying that's generally what happened. I know that this happened in some situations, and that itself is a dimension I didn't know existed. Now, why they would do it, if there was a certain amount of sort of systemic coercion because they felt like it was their role and they had to do it in order to propagate the seed of somebody else. I mean, there were lots of, I think...
There's probably a lot of lonely people back then. You know, society was different.
Yeah.
But I might go back to the basics of your paper.
Okay, yeah. I'm much less an expert on polygamy than I am on sort of theoretical
gathering. You make the point, I think, that there seem to be very polarized positions taken on both sides of polygamy and you were deported today. How can you expect anything else when there are strongly felt positions as the case? Those people believed in polygamy, really believed it was the will of God, and that it was for them to do, and those who were against it felt just as strongly the opposite. And today, when people talk about same-sex marriages, they can be the same way. Is there a way out of that from what you're trying to say?
I think that's the hardest question. I don't know that I could ever expect anything else, and I sort of take it as a given that that's the way it is. Assuming that, I think there's a lot of ground for collective and individual self-understanding that might reduce a fair amount of what otherwise passes as conviction. I would make a sort of a tentative distinction between what genuine conviction and conviction that's based on a kind of fear of knowing things about ourselves collectively or individually that we don't want to know. That's part of my thesis. I also acknowledge that I sort of put as an underlying value here, self-examination and awareness. That's in some ways the product, I'm a product of my time and my culture. That may not be, I mean, it may be that God doesn't value that, and I don't know that, and there's not much I can do to really argue that one or the other. This is a reflection of what I value, but I do think that it's endemic to all kinds of Christian religions, the sort of give and take of this particular problem, and that's why I'm pushing it so hard. I'm not sure where it leads, and I'm not sure in the end that people should give up any absolute conviction, because I think in the end you've got to stand on something. So I think it's a question of going some distance and exploring the middle ground, but I think you're right that in the end, you, if you decide that you're convinced about something, and it's the product of a more sort of critical self-exploration, and I mean self as in my group as well as myself, then I guess I'm more satisfied with that. And I come down to a pretty simple idea, I think. There's nothing too very revolutionary about it at all. Yes?
Theological justifications for polygamy aside, it seems that there are ample practical justifications for it, and the economic matters were mentioned, and even maybe some moral justifications for it, where it was the more moral choice. For instance, if you're in a monogamous society, a man can go out and have numerous affairs and give no regard to the women, or to any children they might bear, and completely disown them. Whereas in a polygamous society, you don't get the conjugal benefits without responsibilities as well. And yet it seems at the time that though the opponents of polygamy had moral, quote, objections to it. What were their, in gay and lesbian things in today's society, people go, proof text from the Bible and find their passages. What justifications did the opponents of polygamy use back then when there are ample examples of polygamy in the Bible itself? What was their reason for calling it immoral?
Well, to give you a simple answer, because it's about the only one I can give you, I think was a profound commitment in 19th century American culture to the idea of monogamous companionate marriage as sort of the cornerstone of family and social life. I don't know that that's changed significantly today at all. I think there's a little bit more flexibility. Why that was the case, why people should choose to ignore, for example, Old Testament analogs while embracing others selectively for their own, it's the way people are, and I guess maybe I go back to my thesis, because they're afraid of something that threatens their sense of identity, it's something that they've been conditioned to embrace.
Question. It might be the case of the haves and have-nots. If you look at the Western settlement and expansion, there was many more men in the West than there were women in every other area other than the territory of Utah. And they're seeing this abundance of women that were collectively under one individual husband probably led to some conflict there because they didn't have any.
Well, again, I think that the harder you look at the experience, the accounts of people who were in polygamy, the more you realize that it's really hard to come up with a one clear way to reason about it.
Feel of responsibility. If you read Mormon Mother, for example, Annie Clark Tanner was neglected by her husband, and you can read it in other accounts of other polygamous wives. So it just depends upon the given family unit.
And I think given the human nature, that within polygamy, underlying the sort of within the church official representations of how things were done, there was a lot of internecine stuff going on behind the scenes about who was asking someone to marry them and whether the husband knew. And so, we've read, and some of these things are really just
there's
shocking.
Up quite a while.
Yes. Kim, sorry.
I'm afraid I'm going to ask in slightly different guys the same.
I'll give the same answer in slightly different guys, I'm sure.
But I see a world in which we're going, it feels to me like we're moving more and more toward what you call soundbite journalism or soundbite discussion. And I really like the prescription that says that's based, at least for the prime discussions, to a great extent on our own insecurity and our lack of self-knowledge, and we need to act through a certain, because we need to feel certain. The answer is that we need to get to know ourselves. The question is, how... I assume that you've thought more about this than I have. How do we encourage that in our community, in our society? It seems to me that we're locked in and we're getting more and more prone toward, I can win this debate in 10 10 seconds of quote that will appear on the nightly news. And how do you get the John Stuart Mill level of analysis out in today's world, or how do you encourage it in yourself? I guess
if anything, I think this is this should reflect the times in which we live. I think in some ways it's easier to sort of make this kind of an argument when there is a more generally assumed or agreed upon kind of higher authority, which we don't have at all in our society, really. I mean, we have it to some extent, I suppose, but compared to the 19th century, we don't. And I teach and I see in my students, even I think notably more than I saw in myself 20 years ago, a kind of unanchored sense of just. I think it takes different forms in every generation according to the circumstances things change. I think it's, in some ways it's harder to argue for this because people want to know where that's going to take them. But it's easier to say, for example, the Sunstone context, we've got this sort of monolithic church party line and we want to sort of get people to think more about it. And that, in a nutshell, is why we're all here, because we want it to be a thoughtful kind of faith. I don't know what kind of faith we could assume everybody out there has if we're talking to people outside the church context. I struggle with that myself. I'm not sure.
Here's a question that's a bit of a paradox. It feels to me that the more certain some core belief is, the more freedom you feel to explore more about yourself. And the more ruthless and insecure you are about what you believe, the more necessity you feel to pretend that you got something that you believe in. So that a kind of certainty of belief might actually produce a more reflective
it's a certain kind of reflectiveness. I mean, I find that I relate more easily in the world to people who have struggled with their own clearly defined religious past than people who don't have that and struggle with a different set of more sort of inchoate issues, which are nonetheless very important. My interest, as you can probably gather, is above all in how people communicate and how they decide who they want to be and who they are. And polygamy happens, in my mind, to be just a historically grounded and rich example of a lot of this going on, but what answers there are specifically about that, or how we should deal with it in the church, so forth. I don't think I have better answers than anybody else. I think it's a great place to look for these kinds of issues because it's something that really defined a whole people.
Can I propose three ladies? There's one in the back, Tracy, and in the middle, and in the front.
Okay, starting with the back.
I recall reading about and writing a paper about Anne Lenny Young in college and the Stenhouses and the public debates in Congress. I'm curious, who bought their books? Who read them? Who went to all the analytic lectures? Did people go for religious reasons, for sensational stuff like going to a circus?
I think a lot of people.
Much about that?
I don't know a lot about that. I have read some things about it and didn't focus on it very much, but my sense from what I looked at is that there was a fair readership for the novels, in much the same way that there's a fair readership for, you can name the authors today that you pull off the grocery cart aisle, sensational kinds of novels. A lot of the other organized Christian religions were kind of in a coalition against the Mormons over this issue. I think they saw that as a way to sort of enhance their own standing in the American community. And I think there was a strong sort of progressive political sensibility represented by people like Harry Beecher Stowe and others who I, generally speaking, admire for most of what they say, and don't dismiss them for what they said about this, but think it's kind of unthoughtful. So I think it was really across the board. That's just a very start of an answer. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, when you talk about identity and you talk about choice, they all had choices. And in history, there is written, like this gentleman said over here, the book on Annie Clark Tanner. If anyone in this room has read it, it's a pathetic saga. Or like her son, Obert Tanner, said in the foreword. And then you look at Susie Young Gates. It was a freedom for Susie Young Gates to be a part of polygamy. And she then went on to practice and move in the liberation of feminism and drink tea with the Queen of England. And then you have these few people that had self-esteem and they had guts. And they weren't going to come to any gentleman's will because they had something that was beyond that, and that was what they wanted for themselves, they weren't in hostage, they didn't loathe it, they were obedient to it, but they took advantage of it for their own right.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Annie Clark didn't take advantage of it. She was a very naive young woman that was swept off her feet, but she hadn't been raised with the ideals that I've got an intellect, and Susie Young Gates felt that, and Eliza R. Snow felt that.
And one wonders, I mean, I've just come across Susie Young Gates and doing some ancestral research, and it appears that she was really just someone who had her hands on a lot of levers.
Oh, and she was a failure with her first husband. She admitted it, and she didn't want to be a part of it, so she said, why be a part of something that's a failure? And left it, and went on to do some very good things. And you find that there is a lot of freedom in women, some women of that time period.
And
even in polygamy, they were delegators. They ran the farm. They sent the money to the man for his mission. I mean, there was no greater environment for a woman to explore her powers of survival than in that period.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I don't think I could add to that. It's just because, on the one hand, there's this tremendous set of opportunities for empowerment and sort of growth in a progressive way that most women didn't experience. And on the other hand, there's still this larger system in which this is taking place that at least I find very problematic for reasons of...
We have that today.
Yeah.
And with our children, we look at our children and we hope and pray that they go the way of feeling good enough about themselves that they can.
Well, and that's how and whether to feel good about yourself is sort of maybe the where I started and tried to.
Her time is gone, but yeah. I promised this lady here she could have a second.
We're going to get a powerful message, no matter what kind of message we get, from the fact that when the manifesto happened, they signed, "We will not practice polygamy anymore," but the church leaders and the higher echelon continued for a long time. To practice polygamy, what kind of a statement on integrity and morality should we or are we getting from what we put forth in the front and what we're doing underground? I think there's a powerful moral statement there for us to understand.
I agree, and I would suggest that kind of underground double talk that was in part the result of the kind of fear of dealing with things directly that I'm talking about. And of course, the political consequences were great.
Well,
but you're right.
It reflects itself in today's culture within the Mormon community.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much for your feedback. I appreciate it.
Thank you.